Now to the college sports world and the battle over whether student athletes should be compensated. Is the NCAA model of amateurism about to collapse? In recent years, multiple states have passed laws allowing student athletes to cash in on endorsements. Eyes are on Florida with its law taking effect July 1st. Wisconsin is one of 13 states without any bills in the works. That's tracking from governing. What are your thoughts about college student athletes getting paid endorsement deals like the pros? 800-642-1234. Nellie Drew is a professor of sports law at the University of Buffalo, where she directs the Center for the Advancement of Sport. Nellie, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much, Kate. Good morning.
Good morning. Historically, college student athletes could only accept scholarships, no endorsements, no salaries. But, you know, sports is billions of dollars, college sports. You know, why was this model of amateurism set up in the first place?
Well, historically, it goes back a very, very long time. When the NCAA, which was initially known as the International Collegiate Athletic Association, was formed in 1905, we didn't have, you know, social media, we didn't have cable television, and the revenues weren't part of the equation. Over the course of time, as the revenues have expanded exponentially, as revenues have appeared to have been become a driving force in collegiate athletics, the pressure has built for that, you know, that windfall, if you want to call it that, to be shared with the student athletes who generate it.
You know, there are states all over the country that have legislation in the works involving student athletes. What is the NCAA going to do about this?
That's a great question. And why they haven't acted before now, I really can't tell you. There has been pressure recently. President Mark Emmert of the NCAA was appearing before Congress this past week, requesting federal help. But it seems like a little late in the game to be doing that.
You know, this issue has gone all the way to the Supreme Court. The justices have a case testing whether the NCAA's limits on compensation for student athletes violate our antitrust laws. Give us some contours of this case, because the players are arguing that college sports is a business.
Yeah, so there's really no question that it certainly is. Although the NCAA has historically hung its hat on the idea that, you know, they produce something that is unique. The amateurism model, it's different. It's separate and apart from, say, the NFL, and that should justify certain lenient treatment, particularly under the antitrust laws. And historically, most of the courts, including the Supreme Court, have bought into this model. But that's harder and harder to defend now. And the case that you're referring to, the Alston case, is quite honestly a frontal attack upon the NCAA's restrictions upon limits on compensation to student athletes that are in non-cash form. Things like, you know, assistance for computers or scientific equipment, musical instruments even, that sort of thing.
What do you make of student athletes really struggling with food insecurity and homelessness and these reports that this is very widespread?
That's a problem. And, you know, it's hard to identify exactly how widespread that problem might be, but the fact that it occurs at all is just unconscionable. And, you know, it's important to recognize that not every single athletic department makes money. According to recent reports from about 2018, there are only 23 or 24 athletic departments across the United States that reportedly actually show a profit. Now, that's deceiving, because money gets plowed back into that same department, right? So you have coaches' salaries, you have, you know, very nice video game rooms, you have all kinds of things, you know, luxuries that go with certain brands. But having said that, it's heartbreaking to see that some student athletes are struggling. And there's actually a Disney Channel movie about one young man who took in his 11-year-old brother as a student athlete because his mother was suffering from some abuse issues. And he was unable to accept rides or meals from the coaches or their wives because it was forbidden under NCAA rules.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Nellie Drew, who is a sports law professor at the University of Buffalo, where she focuses on sports law, discipline of professional athletes, player contract negotiations. We're looking at the fight over compensation and whether college athletes should be compensated. Your thoughts at 800-642-1234. So, Nellie, California's Fair Pay to Play Act, that passed in 2019, the first state-level law to create opportunities for student-athletes to be compensated. How has that gone over?
Well, that was the tipping point, really. That was the first law passed, and although the effective date is not until 2023, that galvanized other states. So what we saw in close succession after that, we saw Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, New Mexico jump on board. Those are the ones that are going live as of July 1st. And it was interesting to note that it was shortly after that, the NCAA initially pushed back and then recognized we have a problem here. And then that's when they first started to recognize that they needed to do something to reform the name, image, and likeness rules as they currently stand, because it wasn't going to work.
All right. Name, image, and likeness rules. Can you explain what that is, how it works?
Sure. So name, image, and likeness refers to a student athlete's ability to capitalize upon their own personal brand. Historically, any attempt to do that would have been seen as a violation of the rule against compensation. The whole point of the NCAA is supposed to be that you're an amateur, not a professional, and that you are not entitled to receive any sort of pay for your ability to perform as an athlete, whether that's directly or indirectly. So that was the basis for this. But it's a very antiquated system. And again, you know, the optics are really bad when you have student athletes, many of whom are, you know, people of color, some of whom may well be from underprivileged communities, working very hard, spending all kinds of time, not in a position to earn compensation any other way because of the amount of time commitment that they are having to devote to their sport. And then, you know, you have the programs which are generating immense amounts of revenue, not sharing those with the student athletes.
Let's bring in a call now. Philip is joining us from Nina. Hi, Philip. What are your thoughts on athlete compensation?
My thought is that amateurism and college sports, at least in the big ones like football and basketball, hasn't really existed in the large conferences like the Big Ten for at least a couple decades now. They work the athletes like they're, you know, like actually workers, but they don't pay them like they are. They have worked long weeks, probably longer than I work, just prepping for games every Saturday. So.
And so I think, Philip, that you would lean toward compensating these athletes in some way. Oh, I think we lost Philip. But, you know, he's saying here that these are athletes who work very long hours, Nellie.
Yeah, that's a great point. And in fact, what really sort of started this whole, you know, train going down the tracks was a case at Northwestern that you may recall from some years ago, where the Northwestern football team decided that they wanted to try to unionize. Now, it's kind of funny. The moral of the story here is you have to feed young male student athletes well, or they get very unhappy. Essentially, what it seemed to be the problem was that they were not getting good food at Northwestern. And then on top of everything else, made them very unhappy. And they decided to try to unionize under the National Labor Relations Act. Ultimately, their effort was unsuccessful, but the process galvanized the student athlete community, and it brought attention to the fact that almost every aspect of their lives was very tightly controlled by the athletic department. And you know, Northwestern's a great school; the football program is you know, fine, but it's not, you know, LSU. And the extent to which these people were being, you know, these young men were being dictated in terms of everything that they did, and the amount of time commitment, as your caller indicated, was extensive, something along the lines of 80 hours a week during the preseason, which when you try to put that together with a full-time collegiate, you know, learning schedule.
How are you supposed to go, get your classes in at the same time, a full class load? That doesn't seem possible.
Yeah. Exactly. And you know, I've got a little bit of a war story. I'm a hockey mom, and my daughter was recruited as a goalie. And at one point we attended a recruiting visit at a D1 institution. And she was informed that when they scheduled their practices, she would be blocked out by the registrar from registering for courses that would conflict with the practice schedule. Yeah. And I looked at her and she looked at me and was like, honey, you know what? This is not what you're doing for your career. And that was the end of that institution for us.
Wow. University of Buffalo sports law professor Nellie Drew explaining where things stand for student athletes in the fight for compensation. Should Wisconsin allow college athletes to sign endorsement deals with shoe companies or car makers? What impact do you think allowing college athletes to get paid and sign endorsement deals would have on recruiting programs? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Nellie Drew on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about compensating student athletes as state legislation around the country could open the door for athletes to get deals beyond their scholarships. Former NFL quarterback Joe Theismann weighed in on Fox Business recently, asking the question, who do you pay?
You're going to start bidding and buying, you know, young kids. And I just think it's a mess if they try and do this.
Would this be across the board for all athletes or just some? Should there be caps and limitations on how much they earn? Join in 800-642-1234. Sports law professor Nellie Drew is with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's bring in John now in Milwaukee. Hi, John. What are your thoughts?
Hi. I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about what the NCAA is considering right now, going to a 12-team playoff system. With a conference champion from each 6 conferences and then 6 at-large bids. That's going to extend the season to anywhere from like 15 to 17 games now for these kids. And it makes, I think, even a better case for them being compensated in some way. I just wondered if you could talk about that a little bit. And I'm going to go off here because I have a kind of a bad connection.
John, are you referring to football?
Yes, football.
Yeah. Nellie, what about extending the season?
Well, I think your caller makes a great point. To the extent that you're requiring student athletes to dedicate even more time in the season to their sport, it certainly makes it more difficult to focus upon academics. And, you know, again, you know, things have changed. It used to be that, you know, you played your sport in the off season, you know, you do what you did. And now it's year round. Preparation and you know, coaching and the like goes on all year. It's a tremendous commitment. And so that's, you know, one of the best arguments that I can think of, that student athletes should be treated with, you know, more consideration and given the opportunity to, you know, generate some revenue from their efforts.
But I think there's also this criticism, as we just heard from Theismann, like, where do you draw the line? Is this Division I, Division III? What about women? What about men? I mean, how do you structure this?
Oh, okay. That's a great question. It's going to be a mess, quite honestly. And I put that right back in the NCAA's lap. This has been coming down the tracks for a very, very long time. And I've been sitting there watching it saying, why aren't they doing something? I can't give you a good answer for that. They didn't even attempt to start addressing it until April 2020 when they formed a working group to develop a group of proposals for how to restructure the name, image, and likeness rules. That working group delivered proposals last November 2020. That is way too late. And then they neglected to vote on it in January. They're still waiting, supposedly later this month when they meet, they're going to be voting on it. But again, this is way too little too late.
You know, Wisconsin doesn't have a law in the books yet allowing college student athletes to monetize their, you know, celebrity status with endorsements. But UW announced it has partnered with Open Doors to kind of create a name, image, likeness readiness program. Can you explain where Open Doors comes in?
Yeah, so there are various third-party platforms that have been organizing over the course of the last couple of years, and we've seen this movement gain momentum. And the idea is that these third parties would provide some sort of structure, some sort of support to both schools and student athletes to help ensure compliance with whatever rules are developed, to provide some assistance to student athletes, as I'm sure you can appreciate the fact you've got 17, 18-year-old young people who have perhaps little business sense entering this world where there will be tax consequences, the potential for fraud, you know, all kinds of things. And the idea is these third-party platforms would provide them with the ability to engage with potential endorsers with some sort of security and guidance.
So as, you know, at the state level with a patchwork compensation, you know, legislation and programs, what does this mean for recruiting athletes to these colleges?
Yeah, well, it's going to be interesting, that's for sure. As of July 1st, we're going to have, you know, 5 states going live with the name, image, and likeness ability to generate revenue. So those would be Florida, Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, and New Mexico. And as of July 23rd, Arizona will enter that mix as well. So if you are a coach of a high revenue sport in one of those states, you're going to have a decided advantage over other coaches, presumably.
Mm. We're talking with Nellie Drew, sports law professor at the University of Buffalo, as we look at compensating student athletes and what impact it would make across the spectrum of NCAA sports. Your thoughts as well, your questions, 800-642-1234. So these changes affecting college-age athletes now, could there be a trickle-down effect to younger athletes, like at the high school level?
Yes, I would anticipate that would happen. And I'm not entirely sure that's a bad thing. When you think about it, historically, we've had 17, 18-year-old student athletes signing, you know, scholarship deals that have vast financial implications, particularly for, think, people who are might be drafted by Major League Baseball or the NHL. They have significant financial consequences without the benefit of counsel. You're not supposed to have an agent. That's one of the rules that the NCAA has put in place to try to preserve its amateurism model. And it's really not a fair transaction under the circumstances. So I'm not opposed to the idea of having high school athletes having access to responsible counsel.
How much more lucrative might this be for student athletes? As you watch these five states go live, what might happen for the athletes?
So that's a good question. I mean, it's certainly a very individual situation, right? Mm-hmm. And we've actually seen situations where significant others of student athletes or of athletes have been able to raise their profile by, you know, using their positions as influencers. Here in Buffalo, New York, we have a player in Buffalo Bills, Jordan Poyer, and his wife, Rachel Bush, is a very strong influencer on social media because of her position, you know, and that's not unheard of. What we've seen as sort of an example is that in cheerleading, which is not an NCAA regulated sport, some young people have been very successful in positioning themselves to make money. There's one young lady named Shannon Woolsey out of Texas Tech. She appeared in the Netflix documentary Cheer, you may be familiar with, and she was getting $5,000 a post. And she's been able to use an agent to maximize her brand, again, because she does not fall within the NCAA regulations. There's another young lady in high school who's been getting $2,000 a post. That's a pretty good chunk of money for somebody in college, right? Or high school.
Yeah. So what are you watching for here as this unfolds at, you know, NCAA, unfolds in the Supreme Court and at the federal level, state level?
I'm going to have a very different syllabus next year. I can tell you that. Kate, I'm not entirely sure what to tell you, except that it's going to be different. And it's an opportunity for change. The one thing we haven't mentioned is the fact that at the federal level, Senator Cory Booker, who is himself a former D1 athlete at Stanford, has taken this opportunity to push for a student athlete bill of rights. Now, this is a concept that has been squashed by the NCAA previously a couple of times, but I think it's important to consider. And the idea is to take this opening to ensure that student athletes receive health coverage and the opportunity to finish their education for an indefinite period of time. Now, the financial consequences of that could be significant, so it's going to require some rethinking. But given the pool of money that March Madness alone generates, I would think it's entirely possible to construct something that would be of benefit to all student athletes.
Nellie, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Kate.
Nellie Drew is a sports law professor at the University of Buffalo. She directs the Center for the Advancement of Sport. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.